You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live.
Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a writer and broadcaster specialising in food and science. This episode is about nutrition for weight management and satiety. Now, this isn't necessarily a new area of research, but there's been a lot more focus on foods recently that help you stay fuller for longer. And the big development we've seen is that some retailers are creating their own range of fuller for longer products as a weight loss aid or a healthy balance range. And this is why I'm interested. So this podcast will explore the scientific thinking behind satiety and its relationship with weight management, new developments in satiety controlling foods, and the expectation versus reality. We've got three fantastic experts for our panel today, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves, and then, after they've introduced themselves, to tell us honestly what they had for dinner last night. Okay, Alex, Professor Alex Johnson, if we can start with you.
So, thanks, Stefan. So, I work at the Rowett Institute, which is part of the University of Aberdeen, and I lead a team there of researchers looking at appetite across the life course. So, I was travelling yesterday, so when I got home,
It's going to be something quite healthy.
I had something really simple, and that was hummus and avocado on toast.
You so made that up.
No, I didn't. I've got lots of healthy stuff in my fridge.
Very good. Okay, fantastic. That's a good start then. Dr. Kavita Kank.
Hi, my name is Kavita Karnik. I lead the nutrition team at Tate & Lyle. You might know us as a sugar brand, but just to clarify, like I always do for UK audiences, Tate & Lyle sold the sugar business a long time ago. So we are specialty food ingredients along with other primary products that we sell. I'm going to take a cue from what Alex said. It's not a made-up story, but it's an exception. I was working very late yesterday, so just had a chickpea and chorizo soup for dinner, but that's not usual. You would not... I was lucky. I can give you an honest answer, which sounds good, but that's not usual.
You're all so healthy. Okay, fair enough, fair enough. Right, Dr. Adrian Brown.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. My name's Dr. Adrian Brown. I am a specialist weight management and bariatric dietitian. I worked in the NHS for around 9 to 10 years, and then I moved on to do a PhD. I currently work at the Centre for Obesity Research at University College London. And so what did I eat last night?
Honestly,
I had steak with beans, which is very nice. And then after that, I had 2 cubes of 90% dark chocolate.
Very good. You seem all pretty good.
I forgot my chocolate. Thank you.
Okay. So I got home very late last night as well. I had an apple and then most of a bottle of wine. And that was my dinner. And I can only apologise for that. I'm terrible. I wondered, could you start the podcast by explaining what does weight management and satiety mean to you?
So I suppose really, if we think about when we're trying to help people lose weight, one of the main barriers to them sticking to a calorie control diet is because they feel hungry. And of course, if you feel hungry, you are much more likely to sort of grab the nearest high energy dense snack, and then you sort of exceed your calorie intake. So that's why, as scientists, we're really interested in these terms, satiety and satiation. So satiety is a term that is used to describe the inhibition over eating, and it's the interval between your meals. So it's intermeal interval, so between, say, breakfast and morning snack or breakfast and lunch. But we also have another term that people tend to use interchangeably. It does mean subtly different, and that's satiation, which is kind of putting your knife and fork down when you've ended a meal. And both these factors are really important to understand how we get people to consume less calories and help them feel full and not feel restricted in any way.
Okay, that sounds pretty good. And as a bariatric surgeon as well, is there anything to add to that?
I think what is very interesting related to satiety in itself or satiation is that it's highly individual. And I think everyone has their own idea related to what it means. And for me, when I'm speaking to patients, it's very much on the idea of when do you exit eating. I think they understand a little bit about satiety and satiation, but the terms are very jumbled in their lives. So it's about really about rephrasing things so people understand how we term things and what we mean when we talk to them in clinic.
Okay, and sorry, I called you a bariatric surgeon. You're a bariatric dietitian.
Dietitian, yes,
sorry,
yeah.
And just back to you again, Alex. So how does this work? Is it a callback system from your stomach sending signals to your brain saying, I am full, or is it a whole bundle of different things?
So I suppose traditionally we think of the brain as being the sort of control centre of appetite. And yes, there are many, many signals that are generated inside our body, so our physiology, our hormones, peptides, metabolites. And they, we kind of think about them as sort of orchestra players, and they're all sort of controlled by the conductor, which is the brain. But also, which is really interesting, that hunger is not just cued by our physiology. Of course, it's cued by things going on outside our body. It could be the external environment. For example, I'm sitting looking at these strawberries and they look really nice. So I wasn't thinking about eating something, but actually visually that cue sends signals to my brain, thinks, oh, that's really nice. They look lovely. I would like to try one. So there are lots of cues that the human body get.
Multiple stimulants that will either make you feel hungry or possibly, are there lots of other stimulants which will make you feel full as well?
Indeed, and that's what we're trying to target when we're thinking about food as a fuel and food formulations that are functional to help us control calorie intake, then that's incredibly important.
Yeah. So, Kavita, now you're at the end of the scale where you're creating the foods for people to eat. How important is satiety and weight management in companies that are making stuff? I mean, are you scrolling through the research going, ooh, that sounds interesting. I need to work on a food to address that.
So we manufacture ingredients and our customers would be the big brand names that you all know about. We do keep abreast of works by such as Alex, various universities and what's happening in the field. What's, I think, critically important is people who make choices, healthy choices or not so healthy choices, is also driven by what's available, what's accessible. So satiety is satiety, satiation, weight management, compliance to any of that is driven by what you find, what you can stick to. So we do a lot of research into clues before eating, such as the texture, the smell, how the product looks like. We do a research on things after the food is consumed. So fibers, for example, is a big thing for satiety-inducing signals. But then in recent years, we have been started looking at post-digestion as well. So gut microbiota, the new science around that, but always keeping the taste in mind. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't taste good, it's very unlikely that people will stick to or have the compliance to stick to any diet.
Now, obviously, Tate and Lyle, everyone associates you with sugar. Sugar and satiety, I mean, that must be a tricky relationship.
So if you talk about white table sugar, that's not us anymore. But yes, I take your point. Satiety, weight management is never going to have a magic bullet, like Alex said before. It's the cues in the environment, it's the obesogenic environment, the portion sizes, the attractions. Well, Alex was attracted to strawberries. I'm sure I'll be attracted to a glass of wine or a chocolate bar on the table. So it's a multifactorial environment. So it's responsibility for everyone. I wouldn't put responsibility just on the end consumer.
Yeah. So, just broadly then, what tools are, practical tools are at the consumer's disposal to tackle weight management and satiety, Adrian?
Well, within clinic, I think, as I said before, a lot of work that I do is particularly around the idea of how people exit eating. Mm-hmm. So if we speak to everyone around the table and I ask you, Stefan, how do you know when to stop eating?
This is the cessation bit.
How would you know? What feelings are you looking for within your stomach or external that identify when to stop eating?
For me, a lot is to do with what's left on the plate. You know?
There you go.
That's a real problem, isn't it? You know?
That's my point about portion sizes, yes.
Yeah, and this goes very much. So you're using an external reference point to indicate when you have finished, not an internal. So we talk about satiation and satiety, which are really important terms to think about. However, when someone is using something different to identify the point of when they stop the meal, it goes away from them having that feeling. And often when people feel, I couldn't eat another thing, and often that could be an exit point for when people exit eating. And I'm sure around the table, everyone's just slightly different.
Yeah, I will say that, and then I know it's the cheese course, and then it all starts all over again. It's terrible. Yeah.
And it's a perfect example when people go out for a restaurant and they go out and they order a starter and it's slightly bigger than they first thought.
Mm, I've had some bread.
Yeah. And then the main course comes and they're like, I'm not sure I can finish that. But they give it a good go and they finish it. And then they go, dessert menu, sir? And you go, I couldn't eat another thing. Oh, yes, okay, yes. Yeah. And suddenly we have this second stomach, if you will, this dessert stomach, which is past that idea of satiety and fullness and goes into something very different.
And the environment is very, very important as well. At home, I will tend to take the amount of food that I need and I put it on a plate. When I'm in a restaurant, because I've paid for it, and I only tend to order things at restaurants that I can't make at home. Mm. You know, there's no point in me ordering something I can make at home. What's the point? It's costing four times as much money. So therefore, it's a special meal, and it's been given to me, and I feel that that's the value is there on the plate. Mm. Of course, it's not. It's all about the washing up and the waste and everything else. But you think you've paid for that thing, and that's why why I tend to finish it. Is that quite common?
That is very common in relationship, but having spoken to people. But also, when people present food on their plate at home, they're using a variety of different things that they've done before, including how much they've eaten through the day, how perception they feel in terms of hunger, but also what they believe from the past will fill them. Mm-hmm. So there's all these previous cues, even before we've eaten, that are linking in.
Before consumption. Before consumption. Mm. What about sitting in front of telly and not noticing how much you're eating? So mindful eating is something that's coming up quite a bit. Okay. Also, some other social cues that Alex talk about. Who are you eating with? So there's never going to be a magic bullet.
Yeah. I can accept there's no magic bullet, but there must be some tools that are at the consumer's disposal. So what are they? What would you suggest to people to use to control satiety?
So I think I would like to suggest that high-protein diets are a very useful tool to help consumers, patients, stick to a calorie-controlled diet. And that's because we know that high-protein diets are particularly satiating. They have the ability to make you feel fuller over a longer period of time.
And sorry, just a minute, why? Why does protein make you feel fuller?
I mean, that is the key question. That's one of the areas of my own research as to what are the cues that invoke protein-induced satiety. And the short answer to that is we don't know, unfortunately. And we can hypothesise that it's linked to the metabolism of protein through the liver, feeding back to the brain, and the release of the amino acids, which are the building blocks of protein. But we know that the amount of protein that you consume is important, in that high protein diets tend to be around about 20 to 30% as a proportion of calories. So consuming that enables you to reduce your calories and stick to a weight loss diet. Now, what's important here is that that does not mean that we also dramatically reduce our carbohydrates. That's not something I would advocate based on my own research, that we know that protein is fermented in the gut, and that can be in itself a risk factor for, say, colon cancer. So actually incorporating that protein with sources of carbohydrate and fibres is actually incredibly important to protect gut health. So, of course, when we talk about weight loss diets, really what you're thinking about is what are the benefits of weight loss per se, and thinking about the medical benefits, against the potential harm of having, let's say, a restrictive regime. Mm-hmm. So in the short term, what you want to do is help people reduce weight. Well, it's not just about that. They want to reduce their adiposity and help maintain their lean body mass. And protein is actually quite effective at doing that too. So that's
why. It's interesting to say, though, isn't it? Because people, again, back to the magic bullet concept, they want to hear a word, the word, and then they can go out and buy their protein bar that has 10% protein in it and thinking that that's tackling the problem. Is that problematic from your point of view?
It is, in that consumers do want the magic bullet, and unfortunately magic bullet doesn't exist. And indeed, we talk about this in terms of giving advice at a population level, and in fact really the future of nutrition and weight management is to give individual advice. So I would take a blood sample and urine sample, give you some questionnaires, get an idea of your personality and habits, and then I would give you a diet that was designed to meet your needs.
Interesting, you said personality.
Yes.
So that's so these are, it's hard to quantify on a clinical level, I guess, isn't it? Personality types defining.
So the NHS isn't set up for looking at weight management in that way. So that's the kind of futuristic, let's say, lifestyle medicine approach that I would like to prevent and treat and give us a healthy body and a healthy mind.
Yeah. So Kavita, have you been looking at products that you can develop to supply people what they need in this kind of way? And what sort of things are they?
So, of course, proteins, and currently with more and more a bigger consumer trend towards flexitarian approach, vegetarian approach, vegetable sources of protein are gaining a lot of attention. Mm. But Alex raised a good point about what happens with excess protein intake in gut health. And fibers plus proteins seems to be gaining a lot of attraction in the research community as well as reformulators. So, like, not every protein is the same, not every fiber is the same. So but if I just take a couple of examples, soluble and insoluble fibers, we tend to associate fibers with something that you see like a bran, wheat bran. But there are other newer generation of fibers that are completely soluble, so could be added to your drinks and smoothies and even clear drinks. When you think about what happens about satiety and satiation, some fibers will create the texture that helps right from the mouth stage of digestion and helps you stop eating sooner by reducing gastric emptying, for example. And some fibers, when they reach the colon and broken down into large intestine, change the gut microbiota formulations so that gut hormones are, satiety hormones are increased and gives a signal back to brain to stop eating or make you fuller for longer. Mm-hmm. So not every fiber is the same. So looking at these newer ingredients, which either just help for fuller for longer or reduce glycemic ups and downs. So reduce your blood glucose levels going up after you eat and going crashing back after a few hours after that is not good for you, not good for your metabolic health, not good for your overall weight management. So ingredients like fibers, which help smooth those curves or ups and downs, as well as improve gut health and gut microbiota, are some of the areas that are coming up new in association with vegetable proteins.
And some actual examples?
So we have been doing research on a couple of our soluble fibers, and one of the well-known ones that's out in the market is beta-glucan, which increases the viscous nature of fluids, so like smoothies and drinks such as that. But then a couple of our fibers, we have shown that they get fermented or broken down into the large intestine. And what Alex said complements very much to that is you want those fibers to reach and get fermented into the part of the colon where there is likely to be diseases of colon. So any fiber that reaches that level and that anatomical part of the colon and gets fermented and improves gut microbiota at that stage is far more beneficial. And then you have the whole concept of, is fiber tolerated? How much fiber can I eat before getting any loose motions or gastric intolerances? So that's why, again, we do a lot of research into increasing the tolerance of fibers.
Yeah. Some recent research that has come out, actually just down the road in Hammersmith by Professor Gary Frost, has looked at inulin propionate esters, so linking in with those hormones, and they've been looking to put them into breads and to smoothies. And they've recently just published a couple of months ago showing that it actually reduced, when given, actually reduced energy intake in healthy
inulin
individuals.
Inulin, is it, you get lots of inulin in Jerusalem artichokes, don't you?
Well, you'll have to eat tons so of much. Them.
Yeah,
So I couldn't resist saying that, but inulin is very well known. Fiber, soluble fiber.
It comes from chicory, though, doesn't it?
It does, but inulin is not very well tolerated. because of the structure, because of the physical characteristics of the fiber.
Yeah.
So some of the fibers we work on, the structure itself, the structure of the fiber itself is designed in a way that it has much higher tolerance.
Just put this back into the real world. What sort of substances are we likely to find these in? What foods that we buy?
So soluble fibers are available right now from beverages, clear beverages, smoothie type beverages, cereal bars, cereals. And the other thing is, soluble fibers are used to take sugar out. So not only they help satiety in the way they get fermented, but they actually help you take the sugar out. And
so inulin tastes sweet.
Yes, inulin has tolerance problems.
I'm just interested in inulin because I wrote a book called Fartology, you see. It's all about the science of farting. So inulin, to me, was just gold dust. But I know that there are different formulas.
I wish I had met you then. because we have shown with some work that some of our fibers are three times better tolerated than inulin. Nearly three times better tolerated. So more tolerated than any normal person would eat in a day. So with all the pluses, but not minuses.
Yeah, you might call them minuses. I like farting.
That's a different territory we are getting into.
What's not to love? Now, okay, so we're getting the development of these fuller for longer products in the shop. So I was just in M&S. M&S are one of the companies that are producing some of these. Alex, do they work?
Well, that's an interesting question because I was the person who developed the Marks & Spencer's fuller, longer range of products.
Give us an unbiased answer on this anyway, could you? But go on, tell us.
That was way back in 2010. So I think the fact that range of products are still one of the highest selling health food ranges in the UK speaks for itself. I don't need to say any more. But yes, essentially they were designed to help people feel fuller for longer with the high protein and the moderate carbohydrate. But of course, remembering that we eat food, not nutrients. So the range of products that are available under that brand they look nice, they taste nice, and people enjoy eating them. And that's really what eating is about, isn't it?
And can you tell us about any of the research that was done on them? So on what sort of scale do they make you feel fuller for longer, if that's possible to extrapolate?
So when I designed the range, it was based on many years of research that I'd done at the Rowett and subsequently since then. So, for example, we've done more work on looking at plant-based source protein because we've seen the trend towards moving away from meat eating to sort of flexitarian. And certainly a lot of Marks & Spencer's customers, when they go in, are not sure what they're going to eat. They'll be influenced by advertising and perhaps will choose to go down the route of, let's say, a meat-free Monday. So we know that when we are consuming protein, it doesn't just have to be from meat. There are many sources of protein from dairy, from poultry. But in the UK, we're not very good at eating plant protein. If we look at our survey data, that the top plant-based source of protein is, wait for it, baked beans. So we have some way to go to embrace getting that range of protein in the diet. Mm.
But in terms of the fuller for longer products, can you tell us, do they make you feel fuller for longer? And how much longer? How does that unfold?
So they were designed and they have been tested in short-term and longer-term studies in men and women where we've given the volunteers and the studies based at the Rowett the range of products. So it was very easy to recruit and get volunteers to take part in this study when they were given the Marks & Spencer's food. And yes, they lost about 2 kilos in the first week and thereafter about a kilo a week. So, and that was when they were allowed to feed what we call ad libitum, so we were allowed free access from that food. So, but giving people food in itself makes it easier to stick to a diet. Mm. It means you don't have to kind of think about the calorie counting. So, but the important thing is that people can enjoy eating a calorie deficit diet. So that is the holy grail of dieting. How can you enjoy eating but still stick to your calories?
Yeah. Mm.
I think in part when we are giving people food, it's, and we talk about satiety. So we specifically, and I specifically use something called a hunger scale. It ranges between 1 and 10. So 1's ravenous, haven't eaten all day, and then 10 is physically nauseous, that very much that Christmas dinner feeling where you can have something else. And what we work on is we work on the idea of eating between fairly hungry and a pleasantly satisfied. So coming out of that sort of idea when we're not overly full. And I think fullness in itself has its own continuum. So if I said stop once you feel full, and a lot of us do, we walk in and go, okay, I finish when I feel full. Often if I say I feel full but I feel uncomfortable, what's happened is people have continued to eat past the sensation of pleasantly satisfied up to a point that I actually feel uncomfortable. Mm. But that's their exit point. So it's slightly misaligned. So when we are presented with food, we continue to eat or want food until we get that often feeling, whether it be plate empty or this slightly uncomfortable feeling. And when we therefore have products or other things, we will continue to eat them or look for food until we get those exit.
So what are the most useful practical tools that you offer your the people that you're treating? What do you say?
So very much the hunger scale.
What do you tell them to eat, is what I'm asking?
Well, the thing is, when you actually have a patient in front of you, the vast majority of people know what a healthy diet is. Hmm. No one walks into my clinic going, oh, I have no idea. So what we tend to do is we do a typical day. So we have a look at what they're typically eating. And then it's very much about guiding the patient, asking the patient what they think. Because often they know what to do, and it's about then giving them some skills to be able to bring those in. So one of the biggest difficulties that we find is particularly around the social determinants of health. And I think we very much talk about increasing certain products or buying certain products, but when those products are too expensive for someone's purse strings, it becomes very, very difficult to give that advice, sometimes that advice. So very much I agree with Alex. I completely agree with related to protein and very much, Kavita, that related to the fibre. So it is very much about getting a balanced diet, but I think you can eat almost too much of a good thing. if you are eating excessive calories in that process as well.
Okay, so what would you tell me?
I think that's the key, isn't it? I think it all depends on how your eating behaviour is. Because if someone, for example...
Okay, I just need a practical example. Give me the last person that you talked to about weight management combining satiety. Okay. What were your recommendations to them? What do you say? You're in the firing line. What are you going to say to that?
Okay, so the person was missing breakfast, and as a result of the missing breakfast, some people can miss breakfast and it doesn't affect hunger at lunch. However, this person was very different. So this person in the morning didn't have breakfast because they were very busy. They rushed out. Had a coffee. By the time around 11 o'clock came, they were, in their own words, starving. So what do they want? They wanted to delay till lunch, but then when it came to lunch, what do they want? They wanted something high fat, they wanted high carbohydrate, and they went to Tesco. Suddenly there's a plethora of options, yeah? So it was a crisp, it was that. So simple things, for example, would be, having a breakfast. And how that would look depends on the personal person that you are. I wouldn't necessarily recommend a smoothie. They tend to affect your blood glucose fairly high, but if they have these wonderful added fibres, maybe that could be something slightly different. I think very much we would traditionally go down the cereal route or something along those lines, maybe some porridge, because again, it's slow release, it does have fibre, insoluble, soluble fibre.
Would you ever say, go down M&S and get yourself some Fuller for Longer, and that'll sort you
if the person went, actually, I really, really like the Fuller for Longer options, they're a healthy option. I've seen them in M&S. Often the issue is not whether I wouldn't... as dietitians, as healthcare professionals, we can't walk up and go, oh, you should have this particular product. We need to offer a range of, different options out
but
there.
But that's also personalization as well. We keep track of the new science and new trends coming up, from consumer trends to actually science trends as well. And asking someone to skip a meal or change the meal routine is far more difficult than just giving healthier options at that routine times. So asking someone to skip a 3 o'clock in the afternoon snack with a coffee is far more difficult to be compliant with compared to just offering them healthier choices at that time. So that's the where we see the whole trend of healthier snacking coming up. And to your point, when you walk into Tesco, you want, of course, you will always see the treat options like crisps and snacks and drinks.
Well, it's often the meal, it's the meal deal, it's the £3 meal deal that people go in for. And suddenly, and I looked at this the other day, one option from one of these supermarkets was over 1,000 calories.
Sure.
And it, and when we were asking about it, it's very much something that someone would pick up and not think about.
Sure.
And again, so it's prepackaged. The size of the meal has been set.
Yeah, exactly. But also what we're noticing, and some recent research has come out from Kevin Hall in the US looking at ultra-processed food compared to unprocessed food. And he did a very, very nice study where he brought people into a centre for a whole month. They were there for a whole month. He gave them 2 weeks of ultra-processed food and 2 weeks of unprocessed food. They were matched for calories, salt, fibre, protein. And what he noticed is simply the fact that these things were ultra-processed meant that people consumed in that week nearly 500 calories more per day, and they gained around 2 kilos in those 2 weeks.
I'd just like to add to that, it very much depends on the definition used.
Yes, so we would go Nova,
Yes, so if it's a definition of number of processing steps, I would argue that something that you would think very healthy is ultra-processed. So instead of just having a very...
At the end of the process, that's been processed within inches. it's cooking.
Juices would be. Some sort of dairy-based drinks would be. So we have to be very careful about labeling such items as ultra-processed. I agree with you that it's more of the content and more of the balanced nature and having options on the team. If someone goes in for that meal deal into any supermarket, if there was an option of a healthier part of a drink, so along with your sweetened beverages, if you had other options, whether dairy-based or vegetable protein based or whatever, having those options, at least some of the times people might make right decisions. Yes, Friday afternoon, probably I won't either.
But if someone definitely goes in and they're not very hungry, i.e. one or two. So we work very much as a from dietetic point of view on behaviour change. We work on understanding people's pattern of eating.
Absolutely.
We understand very much on the challenges that it presents. If someone's never been a breakfast eater, and suddenly we're asking them or suggesting that maybe they should consider breakfast, it's very much balancing up between the pros and the cons.
It is, absolutely.
And the question would very much be, okay, well, actually, some people are later eaters, so they're fine to miss breakfast. It doesn't reflect negatively on their consumption at lunch or mid-morning, having those couple of biscuits. But if it is negatively impacting, it's then the question, okay, where do we want to go from here? And it's very much working with the patient to find out what their goals are, where they want to go, and using them as opposed to very much being a dictator and coming and going, I think you should do this, I think you should do this. This is some information. Yeah,
absolutely.
Go away and think about what you can incorporate.
Added to your overall diet.
Exactly, and how it might impact. And then come back and we can have a chat. And that's so important about the review.
It absolutely is important. And also, like I said, we can create ingredients and solutions, but educating people and working with their own goals. Someone might be more interested in their blood glucose control rather than pounds and kilos, pounds or inches. So that's, you guys are best placed to advise on what works for them, what should be their priority. If someone is heading towards type 2, is pre-diabetic state, their needs are going to be different than someone who's looking for dropping a dress size for a wedding coming up. So very different goals and different solutions are available. Education is a big part.
Very so, Kavita, are you seeing companies wanting to coming to you saying, we want to make this health claim. How can you create something that fits that health claim? And is this a general drift in the way that people buy food? You know, are people looking for food to fit in with what they feel their diet needs, rather than just they want a bag of chips?
So nutrition trends have always been driven to large extent of media influences, celebrity influences, bloggers, people who talk about one thing over the other for whatever reasons. Mm. I would like to make a distinction here between health claims and health benefits. Health claims is a very regulatory process, very strict regulatory process in Europe, needs different level of process. I'm not saying develop different level of scrutiny, but certainly a long process. Science is ready today. It might take a few more years to get the actual health claim. Mm. That doesn't mean we can't start talking about health benefits of either ingredients or foods or dietary patterns or things such as, for example, people who tend to eat more dietary fiber generally from any source tend to have less of certain chronic diseases. Mm. That's a health benefit. Some fibers or some sweeteners have no impact. Some sweeteners have no impact on glycemic response at all. That's a health benefit. So I would definitely distinguish between claims on the packaging versus benefits that you and I and the manufacturers or the dietitians can talk about. Yeah. You can start achieving a lot more by talking about health benefits today rather than waiting for health claims to come in the future.
Yeah. And just to go back to the research that's going on in this area, Alex, what's the landscape of the research? What are the exciting developments that you've seen over the last 6 months to a year? What's cropped up that will be unfolding in the food industry in the near future?
So I think Adrian mentioned, for example, eating patterns. So I would like to mention the interest in the role of breakfast skipping and the benefits of eating a bigger breakfast. So that in particular is something that is very much emerging research in terms of it's becoming apparent that a calorie is not just a calorie, as I would say, and that calories can influence appetite, but also the time of eating can influence potentially appetite and energy balance. The other area, I think, is engaging with consumers to think about what prompts their eating. So, for example, I'm interested in stress. So if I'm talking around the room here, when you feel stressed, probably the research shows that 80% of us will change our eating habits in response to that stress. So do you eat more or do you eat less? Adrian, do you eat more or less?
I very much eat less.
Less. Stefan?
Less.
Kavita?
Less, but driven by carbohydrates.
Yes, okay. So that's really interesting that we can see a difference in response with the same cue. So these are external cues that will influence our eating behaviour. And as a dietitian, Adrian, you can give people advice and they will reach a crisis point of daily hassles and stress, and then they will change their eating behaviour in response to that. So particularly in the workplace context, I'm thinking about how we support people to reach their health goals. I can see that in America is a big thing, but in the UK is not. So, for example, you're talking about portion size. So if I want to go into the NHS canteen and I want a half portion, I do not need a huge whole portion. I can't get that. So I think that the way that the eating environment that we will have in place is very much going to be driven by consumer demands.
Mm-hmm. And very much so. I mean, you're talking there around trigger points and things that trigger people to eat. And very much in terms of techniques that we use as dietitians, we use things, so we call them food and mood diaries. And very much they're used not for the dietitian, they're not used for the clinician, they're very much used for the patient to become more consciously aware. Because when we eat, food just seems to happen. If you then go, okay, so what did you eat yesterday? And everyone had to think around the table, what did they eat yesterday? Oh my God. And it's very much that sort of idea. So identifying triggers, whether it be the 3 o'clock in the afternoon, going and speaking to Jan, as you were saying, Alex, sort of having that couple of biscuits, or in the evening when all the kids have gone to bed and finally I'm relaxing. And then suddenly it's just like I'm watching a bit of TV and go, oh, I wonder what's in the kitchen. And then suddenly we're going into the kitchen and opening the fridge, not aware of what's going on. So a lot of our work is helping people to themselves to become more consciously aware about
Absolutely.
What's going on.
Mindful eating, yeah. having access to foods. Mm. So what you buy, what's in my cupboard. I've learned over the years not to buy certain things ever. If I really feel like eating, I'll go out and buy one of them. Mm. I won't keep them in the house. Or I would always be surrounded by things that are better for me. I'm not saying I don't treat myself, but food access and access to options is a very important thing.
Exactly, that's a very important, and particularly at home, in the home
yes,
environment,
in the home
the
setting.
Kitchen,
yeah.
Having food out on the kitchen desk will instantly identify. They walk in and you're hungry, just coming from work, and there's the biscuit tin calling you. Mm. Hello, suddenly that environment. So making it less accessible. Has actually been shown to reduce down intake.
Yeah. Okay, we should wrap this up, really, but I'd like to wrap it up by going around the table and asking about the future, both in terms of what you think we're likely to see and what you would like to see. So, starting with you, Kavita, the future for you. I obviously don't want to... Don't give us your trade secrets, but what can you see coming on the horizon? Is it consumers wanting different types of products, or is it food producers telling consumers that they want different kinds of products, and how do you respond to that?
Food producers will always listen to consumers. Mm-hmm. Always.
It's that way around rather than...
It's our job as scientists to educate the people who are in the position to make decisions, mm-hmm. whether they are healthcare professionals or food producers. Science doesn't lie. Science doesn't care whether I'm listening as a Tate & Lyle employee or Adrian is listening as a dietitian. What Alex says out of her research is what stands. So the research is going to, I think, drive where we get to in this stage. It could be newer technologies that make screening of ingredients faster and quicker. So previously we would have had to wait for years to see whether this has any effect or not. But there are new technologies coming up that increases the speed of research and the screening, so that's going to change. And gut seems to be more and more into the centerpiece. It used to be brain. Everything came out of brain. Everything was your psychology. Everything was your mood. Yeah. Now we are thinking that even that mood is affected by what you eat. So the old saying of food is sort of you are what you eat. But we are seeing the trend. The future is probably going to be driven by research. Has to be. Absolutely has to be. And the second thing is use of technologies, use of innovations in the research techniques will give us open a whole Pandora's box of some ingredients we may have already known, but not in this context.
Yeah.
So those opening of new doors, I'm looking forward to that as a scientist. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Adrian? What would you like to see happen?
I think it's going to be very interesting to see how the research, obviously, from Kavita's and also from Alex comes out related to particularly related protein. And you've got some very exciting research coming up on satiety and appetite. I think from my point of view, and you mentioned it earlier on around the idea in the future, around the idea of personalised nutrition, where people do come in, and we are able to look at their genes, we're able to look at their stool, their microbiome, we're able to look at their personality and other aspects that might influence them. Because everyone's slightly different. And there was some very, very nice research done from the group that we did, simply looking at a gene related to obesity called FTO. And they looked at people that had a high-risk allele, yeah, or a low risk. And what they found is that the high risk, simply from their genes, were hungrier, and also their effect of after eating of the hunger hormone was actually less suppressed. So simply them coming in and me giving them some dietary advice, actually they're going to feel hungrier than the people in the low risk. But I don't know that by looking at you. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this pans out. I think the microbiome is going to be very, very interesting in how that influences research in the future and how that transcends into clinical practice. But also the use of, you mentioned about technology, but also the use of apps as well. And I think apps are very much a way that we can start to help people more regularly, because what we do know, anything around weight management is very much the amount of contact makes a massive difference. and having that consistent impact. But I, as a dietitian, the amount of dietitians out in the community, aren't able to hit all those people. So I think very much technology will make those
to
next steps.
Personalised nutrition. Then.
Personalised nutrition, but also be that have that continual contact as well. So that contact when in between the times where you might see a dietitian. So the weekly contacts and that sort of idea, because what we do know when we look at the research is very much the amount of contacts can really affect people maintaining their weight loss in the long term.
Fantastic. Okay, and Alex, the future.
So I think the future is going to be around looking at the food-gut-brain axis from a researcher's point of view, and that kind of embraces what has already been said, and that we need to understand better when you consume food, it goes through the intestines, and we used to think of that as sort of mouth to anus, as just food in, poop out. And actually, we now understand that it's much more complex than that. So the diet that we eat can impact on our brain, and our brain will also impact on our gut. So it's what we call bi-directional feedback, and actually understanding the human body in a much more sophisticated way and being able to understand the role of the interaction between diet and our physiology is bound to reveal new pathways to target to help promote satiety and satiation.
Fantastic. Okay, well, let's draw that to a close. Professor Alex Johnston, Dr. Kavita Karnik, Dr. Adrian Brown. This has been Table Talk. Thank you very much for listening, and come back and listen again.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.